Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, or good afternoon, depending on the part of the world you're in. Welcome to Blogger News Network on the radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the show. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is Alan Kelmanoff, who has just published an absolutely fascinating book, Second Ticket to the Dance. Alan, welcome to the program. It's great to talk to you.
How are you? Thank you very much.
I'm doing just great. I'd like to start with a little biographical information. Who is Alan Kelmanoff?
Well, I'm a 67-year-old guy that was born in New York and I guess had a slightly unusual childhood. I ran away from home when I was 14 and ended up by a crazy set of events in France where I hooked up with my French pen pal and lived with him and his family for a couple of years, came back to college, played some football, went to law school in California, got swept up in Berkeley in the civil rights movements of those years, the 60s and 70s, and practiced some law, got a master's and a PhD along the way, taught at UC Berkeley for many years, did a lot of writing but all technical, had a couple of marriages that didn't work out, finally found the right lady and had some kids, house burned down after we got married, had heart virus for 20 years, lots of heart failure, a transplant that came unexpectedly to save my life, and this seems like the second life. That's a thumbnail sketch.
So, just a pretty average life, then.
Not hardly. Makes me self-conscious sometimes to talk about it all, but it has been a very wonderful life. Hard to imagine being more, lucky.
Right. And that brings me onto my next question. Tell us a little bit about the book, Second Ticket to the Dance, which, incidentally, I think is one of the best titles to describe a book that I have seen in the last couple of years.
Well, thanks for that compliment. I like the title an awful lot myself. It was my words for what was happening first before the book was sort of really born. And the book, I guess, came from I was so nervous flying back to get the heart, so anticipatory of what lay ahead when I thought I was going to die and all of a sudden the heart was available and I was going to maybe live, that I had to write just to keep myself sane on this cross-continent flight that I had to take to get the heart. And so I started writing my friends a lengthy mass email that basically said I'm going to get a heart Monday morning or something like that. And when I woke up from the surgery, I just kept writing. And then after a while, I realized that the correspondence was itself a story with a lot of aspects to it. And I became interested in the idea of giving other people who had to face this kind of thing something to look at that wasn't going to be what they went through, but was going to be perhaps informative, maybe inspirational, maybe useful in some way. And that's how the book was conceptualized and conceived.
Okay, and the book itself actually, I think it is split into three very distinctive stories. You discuss your life prior to the operation, and it certainly sounded like you were not expecting to live very much longer.
No, after the heart virus hit me, I was told a couple years later by some cardiologists the numbers, and the numbers were not very good. You know, things like 50% survival rate for the next 3 years, 20% for the next five, things like that. So when I got to 20 years out, I knew that things were failing because I had lots of incidents and lots of hospitalizations and got pneumonia 9 times and all kinds of things. So I knew that the end was coming, and then some things happened near the end that made it pretty certain. So I sold my sailboat, and I was actually getting saying goodbye to my mom when I got the call that there was a heart. I was only on the transplant list 15 days, and the transplant list was generally a 2.5-year list.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that statistic in it itself is amazing. I mean, you must have said, "Whoa, you know, how can this be?"
Well, I did. Maybe not the exact words, but certainly quite close.
Right. And as I recall, the first heart transplant was performed by South African surgeon Christian Barnard in 1967.
Yeah, I remember it.
Right. I assume that the procedure has advanced quite a bit since then, but from reading your book, it's still very far from a trivial process. It's not like having a wart removed.
No, but it is very similar to the open heart surgery that is so common for, you know, clogged arteries and various procedures that are done. And it is no longer a high-risk surgery compared to any other major surgery. The real sort of daunting aspects of it occur after, when you wake up and have the period of time of kind of making sure that you live through it and that you are cultivated and educated to the next stage of your life, which is very different than the prior life because of the medications and being immune suppressed.
Right, and there is also the fear of organ rejection.
Well, it's a reality that any foreign object in your body that's organic, like your somebody else's heart, is going to be rejected by your body just as a splinter would be by a small wound in your finger. It'll swell, it'll create white blood cells, and eventually expel the splinter. To avoid that, they give you immune suppression meds for the rest of your life, and that makes you immune suppressed, and so it's like trading diseases in a way, because you're now open to a whole lot of things like cancer and getting sick easy. But there's a lot of advances in care, and so I have, although I started off getting sick pretty often, I have actually not been sick enough to go to the hospital but once in the last 20 months.
Wow. I didn't realize that the immune suppression drugs went on for the rest of your life.
They do, although there are new experimental procedures for heart transplants where they take bone marrow from the donor as well. And if you get that, apparently, in some cases, they've been able to recreate the donor's immune system in the recipient. And those people get off the anti-rejection meds and develop an immune system and lead much more normal lives. But I don't know much about that because that followed me. But when I read about it, I certainly did call the donor family to find out if they had harvested any bone marrow, which they had not.
Let's talk about some of the actual process, if you will. How long were you in the hospital?
I think 8 or 9 days, as I recall, but certainly I was up and walking the next day, and not very spryly, but certainly they get you up and they make you walk, and the hospital stay was not unconscious or anything like that. It was kind of an interesting period for me psychologically. First of all, just waking up was quite miraculous, and by that time, I knew a lot of people in the hospital, so there were people coming to visit, etc.
8 or 9 days. I'm amazed. I would have thought that with some major surgery like that, you know, the stay would have been much, much longer.
Well, I actually expected a longer stay as well, but again, this is a surgery that resembles the normal open heart surgery, if ever that is normal. And they have it pretty well down, and they don't like to keep you in the hospital too long because you easily get sick in the hospital in some ways. So they get you out, and they get you walking. And then, of course, right after that, you have to keep going back 4 or 5 days a week for quite a while for various other procedures and clinics and this and that. But, yeah, I guess I was expecting I don't know what I was expecting because I wasn't expecting the heart until, you know, 8 or 10 hours before I got it.
And after you left hospital, how long were you in, you know, pretty much, you know, constant care?
Well, I went home. I didn't go to any intermediate facility. It took me about 45 minutes to get up the stairs of a three-floor house. But gradually, I don't know what the definition of regular care is. I mean, it started off 4 days, 5 days, even sometimes a week, going back across the bridge to San Francisco to the hospital for various things. But now, just to give you a sense of it, 4 years later, I have like 2 clinics a year and maybe 6 blood draws, and that's it. I don't have much else. So it's a gradual process of getting off the medical part of it. At first, it seems like it's taken up your whole life and there's no room for anything. It's very hard for me to work or do stuff I wanted to do or even start the book in some ways because there was so much medicine in my life at the beginning. But it gradually tailed off.
I presume that, you know, with the anti-immune drugs, certainly at the beginning when you were released from the hospital, you had to take some pretty careful precautions.
Well, at the beginning when they're getting you on the meds, there are a lot of things that can happen. They start you on the immune suppression drugs, and they raise your blood pressure tremendously, so they have to then give you drugs to lower your blood pressure, and there's a lot of the meds that you take that require other meds to deal with the side effects. And, you know, I have been lucky in my life, even though I played ball and did a lot of active things, I'd never been unconscious, but I came pretty close after the transplant just because of the meds. I got to get down on the ground a number of times from being lightheaded so that I wouldn't fall. But gradually they get you, you know, high, low, until they get the drugs just right. And then even now from time to time there are slight changes due to a blood draw and they like the level to be higher or lower. But it just takes some time and you get to it.
Just out of idle curiosity, it's 4 years since your transplant. How many different drugs do you take?
Well, I take 50 pills a day, if that's a good measure.
Lord.
Yeah, I take a handful when I wake up, another smaller group right after breakfast, a huge group at lunch, another small group before dinner, and a big handful before I go to bed. And it takes me, I lay out about 30 days worth of pills once a month, and it takes me about an hour and a half to do that. I have found that doing it once a month for 30 days is a lot better than trying to do it every day. It's a lot of meds.
Oh, no kidding. I mean, I thought you were going to answer something like, well, you know, I take, 3 pills a day.
I take things in addition to the basic anti-immune, you know, anti-rejection meds, they call them, Prograft and Myofortic. I take a bunch of stuff for lowering your blood pressure, hydralazine, Tocqueville, different things like that, Basotec. And then I take a bunch of meds that have to do with what the immune suppression drugs do to your body chemistry. So that's vitamins and calcium and magnesium and omega-3 and on and on and on, because there are things that wash out of your system on account of the anti-rejection meds and so on as it goes. So, and then I have things that are normal for an old man, like glucosamine and things that are for joints and arthritis and on and on, not necessarily high-powered drugs, but more homeopathic kinds of things. But big total of pills, big total.
Oh, it certainly sounds like it.
Mm.
Did you also have to change your diet and exercise regime?
Yes and no. First of all, it's hard to exercise because I ended up, I went into the surgery kind of on crutches from a knee injury that hadn't been repaired. I had many knee surgeries and I was due for one, but the heart transplant kind of came first, of course, and then they wouldn't let me have the knee surgery for a year after that. So because I was on crutches, my sternum never healed properly. I have a sort of a split, or what they call ununified sternum. That limits your exercise, and it's only more recently that I've been able to start exercising, and not as much as I'd like, and I certainly have put on weight, and I'm flabby and not very happy about the condition I'm in, even at age 67. As far as a diet is concerned, they like you to use a heart-friendly diet, low on salt, low on saturated fats, and I try to work in that direction, but it hasn't helped me lose a lot of weight, I can tell you that.
One of the really, really delightful parts of the book is the online aspect. You called the group Nightwires. Tell us about Nightwires.
Well, at the beginning of this, you wake up from surgery, and I remember it very well because I had a tailpipe down my throat from a ventilator and very uncomfortable, but finally get that out. I remember what I said first. It was something like, I really owe the world now. And I did start writing again that evening, on my little laptop computer in the hospital, because it just was, finally everybody went home, and there I was with a second life just starting, and nobody to talk to about it. So I continued the same email from the airplane to my friends, and it later that night, maybe 1 or 2 or 3 in the morning, it's hard to know, I was up and high on prednisone, which is a steroid they give you after the surgery, which makes you very lucid and very, what's the word, kind of like elated, beyond just the second life, but maybe drug-induced elated. And I was so, what's the word, happy to be with my new brain and my new, you know, newly perfused brain, that is, and feeling so alert and sensitive and happy and excited and, again, probably a little bit drug-induced elation. I just wanted to write. I wanted to communicate. And so I just, here it was 3 in the morning, and I was sending very personal and important messages to all my friends and acquaintances through the night air, so to speak. And just one moment there, the Nightwire word came to me, and I thought that was a good description of what I was doing.
I think I asked you this question in an email. The Nightwire group was what, about 30 people or something?
Yeah, although it did vary. I got letters from people who'd heard from others who said, please include me after a while. So it expanded, and it got less frequent. It started off being every few days, and it ended up being every few months before I kind of tailed off.
Right. And just for listeners, Nightwires essentially became a support structure. And what Alan has done in Second Ticket to the Dance is include many of the Nightwire's conversations. And they do make for just wonderful, wonderful reading. And I know that many of the messages were obviously supportive to you, but many of the messages were kind of supportive to other people as well.
Well, sharing this kind of communication about life, the tenuousness of it, the lightness of it, the intensity of it, the nature of mortality and the feelings of starting all over again, tends to get people interested, and so lots of conversations through email resulted. And I did find other people were being open with me about their crises or some crisis in their family. There were lots of very personal exchanges of all kinds, and lots, as you say, inspirational or supportive. I remember one really good friend of mine wrote me back and just simply said, "Glow, Cal, glow," because she was picking up the, you know, the enormous elation that I was managing, and just, I guess it was infectious for her. And then a lot of people wrote back, and their emotions were very infectious for me, very inspiring. And there were times when I was having a hard time, and these emails were sustaining in lots of ways.
The third aspect of the book, and one that, again, I found very moving, was the interaction with the donor's family. I believe the donor was a 21-year-old.
Yes.
And you actually decided that you wanted to seek out his parents and I guess thank them. I think that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah, it sounds like such a trivial word in the face of such a big gift, but yes, I wanted to thank them, and I felt like, you know, I owed them a great deal and didn't know what kind of needs they had for support or contact, but I figured if I had I have a 16-year-old daughter. If I had a 21-year-old kid who was killed in a car accident and through his wishes I donated his heart to somebody, I'd like to find out who got it, and I'd like to find out what kind of life they were going to lead with my son's heart. And just that kind of feeling led me to try to contact the donor family, Barbara and Craig Cromwell, Lucas Cromwell's parents, who live in Grants Pass, Oregon. And in fact, my family and I just got back a couple weeks ago from going up there to visit them, but they had come down to see us a couple times previously. Once I finally contacted them, we did make personal, you know, physical face-to-face contact and spent some very, very warm and, I can't help but say, extremely intimate times with them, just getting to know them and being, now they're sort of part of our family and vice versa.
Was it difficult to locate them?
Yeah, because the intermediate agency that deals with the communications around heart donors and organ donors in general starts off with its primary value being privacy and confidentiality, so you practically have to break into the Pentagon to find out who the donor was. And it took a long time, and there were a couple of clerical errors that contributed to it. But then one day, I got a postcard, and then it was very easy.
Mm. Looking back, both prior and post your transplant, What was the worst moment?
Well, before the transplant, there were lots of worst moments because I was a very sick guy, and you know, I remember trying to put a pair of chains on a car in the snow one time, and my heart failure was so bad I literally couldn't get out from under the car. I had to call somebody to drag me out because I just didn't have the strength to push myself back out. I remember something called a VTAC storm. I had an implanted defibrillator in my chest, that size of a pack of cigarettes, that would shock my heart and restart it when it went into a bad rhythm, my old heart, which was swollen and short-circuiting all the time, so to speak. And so one time, right near the end of what I like to call my first life, I had a VTAC storm. I think I had like 9 or 12 defibrillations in under an hour. And although I've had defibrillations in the past, and they're not pleasant, I was fairly tolerant of one or even two, but 9 or whatever it was more or less certainly the end of my life. I tried to say goodbye to my wife in the middle of that episode, and I had a lot of pain that night, and a lot of I was in ICU for some days, intensive care unit, the hospital. It was a train wreck. It all happened in the hospital. Had it happened on my sailboat or out on the street or in Italy or someplace like that, I would certainly have died from all those shocks. But in this case, I was where I could be cared for. But it still was a train wreck. That was a bad time.
What sort of reader feedback are you getting?
Well, it's very interesting. I get two kinds. I get kinds from people who know me and kinds from people who don't. People who don't tend to be curious in much the same way you are, Simon, and asking the kind of questions, you know, that you're asking, and also talking about things that have happened to them or fears they have about something like that that might happen. One of the other recipients of Lucas Cromwell's organs contacted me. Apparently the book was inspiring enough to him to get him to start communicating with the donor family as well, which was quite rewarding for me. And then my friends and relations and other folks, they were quite moved by the book, because putting it all together is different than the individual night wires and adding various things in our lives that paralleled the transplant, including restoring an old house in Italy before and after, and the contact, most importantly, with the donor family and all that came with that, were things that made the story whole for other people who knew me well but didn't know. Knew only a few parts of it, or knew the whole in pieces. So I got a lot of, I had no idea, you know, kinds of beginning sentences. It was very interesting. I've had lots and lots of feedback from both people who know me and people who don't.
That's great. Where can people purchase their own copy of Second Ticket to the Dance? Because they're not getting mine.
Well, thank you for that, Simon. You can get it on Amazon, just under Second Ticket to the Dance. You can get it as a Kindle electric book, or you can get it as a paperback. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Bicom. Those are the ones that jump to my mind. I haven't had to buy a lot of copies myself, so I don't know where else. But I think it's generally available in bookstores, or you can ask for them to get it for you, and they can get it pretty quickly. I know that. You can get it directly from Outskirts Press, which is the self-publishing publisher that I employed. And that's about it.
Okay. And do you actually have a website that people can visit?
I do. And you can look at a website that's called Second Ticket, all one word, .ilpp.org/. And it's, I'll say it again, secondticket.ilpp.org/. That'll show you the book's website. But it's still, I wouldn't call it the slickest website in town. It's more or less the first stage of a website. Pretty soon there'll be a lot more on there. But it's got some interesting aspects, I think, of the book and the background to it. And it's a place to sort of pick up on other people's comments, a couple small movies, this and that came along with it.
My next question, I think you've answered it for me. I was going to ask you how long it took to write, and from what I am guessing, it basically took from the time you got on the airplane, knowing that you had a new heart waiting for you, until the day the book was published.
That's a fair statement. Yeah, it took a while. It was very limiting to be ill, to be recovering from major surgery. It was very hard to be writing. But there were some periods of time during some summers when I was able to really get after it. I had a very able editor who helped me with some ideas about organization and dealt with the really tough part of taking very informal stream of conscience kinds of emails and making them at least readable to those who had, you know, certain standards for the way they read their books. And then there was, at the very end, you know, the maxim that the last 10% of the project cost 90% of the money. Well, this project took a lot of energy and effort right at the very end, just to sort of detail out, get permissions, do this and that. But, you know, it did take a long time, and it was limited by the surgery.
You've mentioned Italy a couple of times in our discussion. I want to know, what is your connection with Italy? I understand you own a house there.
Yeah. It's first of all, it's one of these things where, you know, it's like a busman's holiday. I'm not a wealthy guy. I spent most of my life being an academic and a consultant that didn't make too much running a nonprofit. But I visited my aunt in Lucca, Italy one summer because she had her whole family there, and I took my wife and then one child over there, and we fell in love with the area around Lucca, stayed far enough away not to be in their face at a little town called Somma Colonia, and liked it so much we went back a number of times, made some friends. And then one day, driving up a dirt road, fighting like cats and dogs about dirt roads, because I like to go up dirt roads and my wife hates to. I had to go fast because I was afraid of getting stuck, and I had already decided to turn around as soon as I could, and I went around a curve, and there was this little arch built in 1202 in a teeny town of 35 houses overlooking the world and one of these dream places. And just on a chance, I asked somebody there about a house, and they pointed to this old ruin that you could hardly see. And to make a long story short, I bought it for a very low price from somebody who lived in England who'd inherited it and had never seen it, and thought of it as an abandoned ruin, which it had been. And we restored it. My wife wanted it, and I thought, well, maybe the last project of my life. Let me see if I can get this thing restored before I die. And it was like a foot race in a way. But it became, in some other ways, in the book too, a metaphor for, what's the word, living to the last second as hard as you can and trying to leave something behind that stands after you leave. It was an 800-year-old building, so certainly was going to be there again in the future. It was maybe one of the reasons I was interested in it. And we now try as hard as we can. We rent our house in Berkeley so that we can afford the airfares to go to our house in Italy. And we rent our house in Italy, so that we can afford to come home. But anyway, I look up at the house sometimes from down below at the swimming pool. I've never, ever owned a swimming pool. And I feel like a millionaire. But believe me, I'm not. I just have a millionaire's life, I guess, is the way to say it.
Right. Are you planning to continue to write?
Well, that's a good question. I guess, you know, if enough people buy the book so that, I mean, I have the first royalty check came yesterday. It's $191.16. I actually want to call Outskirts Press and find out how many books have sold and what that means. I know it's selling pretty well, but they may have taken some costs out of it, or who knows. But if it sells as an indication that it's any good, I have no other better way except Simon Barrett's excellent review to say that it's good. I suspect I will. I'm not going to stop working because I love my work, and I do have a very busy and full life, but the doctors tell me I could live 20 more years. And so, yeah, I think I would. I'm not ready to make a decision about it, but I've a lot of things. Now that I got in the habit of writing about feelings and perceptions and metaphors about the world I see, instead of the technical work that I've always written about, I enjoy it so much that if I have almost any real good reason to write something again, I probably will.
Okay, we're just about out of time, but this question has been nagging me since we started talking. You're 67 years old, and you're still working very hard. What is it you do?
Well, I'm a criminal justice planner, and I work in the criminal justice system. I get appointed by judges over police departments that have settled lawsuits or prisons and jails that they need to police the court order over the lawsuit. I get hired by counties that are overcrowded and have jails and criminal justice systems that are bloated with inefficiency, and they need consulting work to try to help them. And I have a nonprofit agency that I direct that does that work. And sometimes I do investigations. And I do really enjoy it. And I am 67, but don't forget I have a 24-year-old heart. And that gives me a great deal of vitality and energy back that I used to have. And I'm in no way thinking of retiring. I have the best possible life, and I'd like to see if I can give the world something more back on the on the dead, if you know what I mean.
Alan, our time is up, but it has been wonderful to talk with you, and I know I speak for everyone here at Blog and News in wishing you every success with Second Ticket to the Dance, and more importantly, every success for Alan Kalmanoff.
Well, thanks an awful lot. I think I've already had the big success, don't you think?
No, there's plenty more to come.
When people wish me good luck, I sometimes say to myself, I've already had it. But anyway, thanks an awful lot for the interview and for your review and your work, and I've enjoyed this brief chat.
I'm sure that we will talk again.
Okay, I look forward to that.
This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a wonderful Tuesday, and we will be back on the air again soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.